This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale. Now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton,
KBOO News. For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Israeli President Moshe Katsav is accused of rape and sexual harassment. Anti-immigration demonstrators target Portland day laborers. And civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart is sentenced to 28 months in prison on terrorism charges.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,768 officially acknowledged deaths of American troops, plus an additional 143 American contractor deaths. Iraqi physicians estimate that 655,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. The U.S. has also reported that 20,687 people have been wounded.
Good evening. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 16th, 2006. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Mike Monkbold.
Oregonians Against Immigration Rights held a demonstration near KBOO Studios in inner southeast Portland last Saturday. The demonstrators, toting cameras and notebooks, said they were targeting Portland's largest day laborer pickup point. KBOO's Eduardo De Landeros Tierra has the story.
How come you're all white? Hey, you gringos are afraid to work.
Doing the job our government won't do.
Which is?
All the above. Protect our borders.
A small, well-worn truck is parked at the corner of Burnside Street and 6th Avenue, where Paolo, Jasmina, and Marta serve food. They have a welcoming smile along with probably Portland's best burritos, quesadillas, and tortillas, all handmade. They give this all free to the Mexican day laborers on this busy, non-official temp agency.
Ay, pobre gente.
Paulo from León, Mexico.
We have to know that poor people are lonely and in pain. They are drowning and we must help them.
Their warmth, though, is facing a group of people with protest signs that say, "We love America and we must protect our borders." These people have come from Salem and McMinnville, Oregon, to pick the area of Ankeny and 6th Streets. This is where the ordinaleros, or day laborers, stand on the sidewalks, starting about 5:30 a.m., looking for any job that might be offered by a passing truck or car. Some of these people are from the McMinnville-based Oregonians for Immigration Reform and the Oregon branch of the Minutemen. They've been at this corner since 7 in the morning, walking and carrying their placards. Across the street is a Portland police cruiser. There is a Latino male, too, in the crowd, saying he works for the government and won't say any more. The laborers say he is an undercover officer of some type.
We're trying to deter employers from hiring people that are not authorized to work in America. It's working out great. Hardly anybody's stopping today.
Rick Hickey, Vice President of Oregonians for Immigration Reform.
If people illegally in this country can't get a job, they're going to have to go home.
Well, the Minutemen are a group of citizens who want the federal government to do their job on immigration.
Mike Forrest, head of the Minutemen based in Salem, Oregon.
That's what we're here for, is to make a statement. And Oregon Minutemen is, if we're not on one of the borders, then for Oregon, what we're going to have to do is more interior enforcement. What I want to see is, I don't like these people being exploited. When a contractor does come by, that's exactly what's happening. No taxes are being paid, and it helps the contractor. The contractor's making money, but it exploits people also. But what we're saying, like I say, the statement is, Oregonians are going to have to start standing up and speaking to the representative, saying it's time to do something.
The Minutemen and Oregonians for Immigration Reform say that illegal workers are a massive economic burden on the U.S. Illegal workers take away jobs from legal workers who do want a job. Everyone has a right to survive, but not at the cost of the U.S. Others say the so-called illegal workers are actually contributing to the economic system in positive ways. Otherwise, trucks and cars would not be coming to this busy corner every day to hire the workers.
I think the fact is that we've lost a lot of jobs here in the United States in the same way that they're losing jobs in Latin America and Central America.
David Carrier from the Catholic Archdiocese of Portland.
And so they're victims of the same economic globalization that we experienced here. There are no good jobs there now, just like there were no good jobs here 20 years ago for people on the low end of the income scale. So it's fundamentally an issue about economic justice and human rights. And people all over the world have a right to the means of survival. They have a right to a good job. And if they can't find a good job in their home country, then they got a right to come here and find a good job here.
Paula, Marta, and Jasmina keep to the side of the trucks, watching with their warm smiles. Jasmina from Mexico, too, studies people's faces, and with proud eyes, shiny dark hair, she tells me, everyone should have a place to live and something to eat. Just be kind. She shakes her head and then looks at me. We both understand each other. I smile back at her. She touches my shoulder. Food is good for the soul. You want to cook with us? I say, yes, I like to cook. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, KBOO News.
Vamos a comer?
Last Saturday, Washington and Oregon residents joined communities all along the West Coast in rallying for clean energy and against the construction of a liquefied natural gas terminal and pipeline on the Columbia River. Members of the Columbia River Clean Energy Coalition marched along the Lewis and Clark Bridge from Oregon to Sacagawea Park in Washington. KBOO's Chris Andre caught up with the marchers, literally.
I'm here in Longview now, across the river, and I caught up with the people marching against the liquefied natural gas facility here. And I'm talking with Dan Sears, is that the way?
Dan Sears, yeah.
Dan Sears. Dan, good morning, and thank you very much for being here and putting this event together. Tell us a little bit about what's happened so far.
Well, we gathered here in Longview, and we took a shuttle down to the Oregon side of the Lewis and Clark Bridge. And everybody marched over the Columbia River, which is going to be the pathway for liquefied natural gas vessels coming up from far away, from other countries to come to Oregon, basically to send energy to California.
So there's environmental concerns and there's also safety concerns. Tell us a little bit about some of the safety concerns that local residents might be considering at this point in the process.
Well, a large contingent of folks we have here are from Kathlamet, Washington, and also from the Oregon side of the river. And these people live very close to the terminal site. And the safety concerns for them are very substantial. One is with tankers coming up, the impact it'll have on recreational boaters and other people who use the river. And then there's safety concerns with what would happen if something went wrong at the facility, either an accident or, one ship hitting another or, God forbid, a terrorist attack. And that's a concern with these vessels because they carry such vast amounts of energy and that people, from 1 to 3 miles away might be affected by the fires.
Would you say the channel in the Columbia River that's in the path of this thing, is that a relatively easy or difficult channel to navigate?
That's a great question. It's a very difficult channel to navigate. And the bar is known as the Graveyard of the Pacific. It's a very dangerous bar. At first, right at Astoria, and we have people here from Astoria as well. And, the channel coming up is quite narrow. It's 600 feet at, I think, its widest point. And near the site, it's about 600 feet. And so turning a tanker that can be 1,000 feet in length in a 600-foot channel obviously doesn't work. It's just not well suited to this kind of vessel. And big vessels come up the Columbia River and come into Portland, but they don't come up carrying such explosive cargo.
When you say explosive, what sort of explosion? What sort of force are we looking at? What are we considering here?
Actually, slightly misspoke there. It's not so much an explosion; it's a flammability risk. So, if you were to even have a tenth of what's on this vessel leak and catch fire, people 3 miles away could be burned and could be facing potentially, you know, potentially fires in their backyard, or people a mile away will receive second-degree burns after 30 seconds. And that comes from a Sandia National Labs report. That's not, you know, NIMBY people or environmentalists or anybody else making that point. That's a concern in all the sites. And there are other protests happening today in Mexico, in California, and in Southern Oregon on the same issue. People who have the same safety concerns and don't want these things in their communities because they feel that they're unneeded and they're unsafe.
That was Chris Andre talking with Dan Saris from the Columbia River Clean Energy Coalition. For more information on the web, go to www.neenergy.org.
On Thursday, the 26th of October at 7 p.m., members of the Chaussee family, Portland Cop Watch, the Park Rose Community Church, and others will honor James Chaussee Jr. in a candlelight vigil. The candlelight vigil, titled Love One Another, remembers Chaussee, who died in Portland in police custody September 17th of this year. Chaussee is remembered as a peaceful man who did not wish harm on anyone. For more details, they can contact Portland Cop Watch at www.portlandcopwatch.org.
The current time is 5:11. You are listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River. As we ask you to become a member of KBOO Community Radio, please make a pledge by calling 503-232-8818 or 877-500-KBOO. Time now to go to Lisa Loving.
Hey, I'm Lisa. I'm joined by my super cool friend, Celeste Carey, who's one of the incredible powers behind Monday Morning Talk Radio, along with Cecil Prescott.
With Cecil Prescott, right.
And Celeste, we're in the middle of the happy membership drive. We're just passing the hat for KBOO. That's all we're doing. We're asking people to just put their money in the front of the machine instead of worrying about later on when society collapses and they have to put their money in the back end of the machine.
Oh, my.
So go ahead and give those numbers.
Okay, well, here's the first number. This is for all of our outlying friends and supporters. It's 1-877-500-5266. 1-877-500-5266. Now, let me go a little further out because we have friends and listeners and supporters even way outside the environs of Oregon. And that would be www.kboo.fm if you want that kind of connection. Now, we know we have friends who listen far and wide away. So what you do is, while you're listening, just go to our website and choose the Join Now button. Click on that and make a pledge. Become a member if you're not a member. Re-sustain, re-up if you are a member. If you're inside the Portland metropolitan area, 503-232-8818. That's 503-232-8818.
So actually, we put a lot of work into the evening news broadcast. It's one of the only one-hour news broadcasts that's produced by a community radio station in the whole United States. And we know that because we spent some time this summer meeting other people at the Grassroots Radio Conference at the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. And for us to be able to network with other people, attend these conferences, costs money. For us to be able to send Eduardo to the anti-immigration protest that he went to Saturday, we have to pay for the equipment, the Marantz tape deck that he took with him. That's what we're asking you to help pay for, 503-232-8818. And to make it a little easier for you, we're giving you some super special thank you gifts. For a $90 minimum pledge, we've got Static by Amy Goodman. Her new book, along with her brother, they're investigative reporters. They're looking at radio interviews and commentary with secondary sources on charged issues that the corporate media too often overlook. For $75 happy pledge, Jason Leopold's book, News Junkie. That is such a readable book, I'm telling you right now. Leopold, one of the reporters who broke the Enron story, is now breaking his own story about how he got addicted to cocaine, committed grand theft, cleaned himself up, and found happiness as a news junkie. He's also the guy that broke the Karl Rove indictment story, which, as we know, ended up turning into this whole story of its own. Karl Rove ended up having to admit that he was the Bush administration official that told, that confirmed for Robert Novak that Valerie Plame really was an active CIA agent. And also one more for a $75 minimum pledge, Cable News Confidential by Jeff Cohen, producer, pundit, and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting founder. It's his fast-paced romp through the three major cable news channels, Fox, CNN, and MSNBC, delivers a serious message about their failure to cover the most urgent issues of the day. We are asking you to call us because, look, we're not just hanging out here.
We're not just playing
around.
We're actually covering those major and urgent issues of the day.
Incredibly.
We get behind the scenes. You're listening to reports that the major media outlets will not pick up. Why? Well, because it contradicts with their mission. Basically.
Check this out. We've got a story coming up on this broadcast about the Schnitzer family. Woo-wee! So the Schnitzer family, Schnitzer Steel Corporation, totally convicted of bribery, okay? And we, you know, we took the AP story, we eyeballed it and went, I think they're leaving a few things out.
Just a few.
So we took a reporter, put the reporter on the story, dug up a little bit more information about what the Schnitzer family's been doing to bribe people. Fascinating, and they're busted. But anyway, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. You know, in fact, the Oregonian was written up in the New York Times today. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, Lisa, tell us about it.
Story about Macy's teen department has these T-shirts they're putting out that are like beer bong. Anyway,
oh,
it's
yes.
They're basically their marketing T-shirts
marketing
to people who can't
alcohol.
Afford that. Anyway, so we'll be doing something about that one tomorrow because that one kind of came up and went, woo, we wanted to do something more
about
Oregon
it. Oregon Partners are one of the groups to kind of help work against getting those T-shirts marketed to teens.
It's pretty shocking stuff. 503-232-8818 or toll-free outside the Portland area, 1-877-500-KABU. We also welcome people coming in person to 20 Southeast 8th. That's in Portland, Oregon, half block south of Burnside.
Newsflash.
Okay.
We encourage 5 new members this hour. That's the news flash. And we know you can do it. We know that you have been waiting for that personal invitation. We've made this news very relevant to you. We get behind the scenes. As Lisa has pointed out, as the intrepid leader of our PM news department, there are many stories that just seem to somehow miss the boat when it comes to sailing into your consciousness via the mainstream media. Not here at KABU.
No, and we are ready to go back to Michael Monkfold and Lisa Lewis. They're live in studio too, but the number to call, 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266
or 500-KBOO.
Next break, we're going to tell you more about what your investment in KABU will win for you. Mike, Lisa, back to you.
All right. Thank you, Lisa and Celeste. The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear an appeal from the Hecla Mining Company involving the cleanup agreement for the Bunker Hill Superfund site in Washington State. The company says the U.S. government broke its promises, resulting in vastly higher costs. Hecla wanted the high court to consider whether a federal judge could modify the consent decree Hecla signed in 1994. The company says the site was expanded from the 21 square miles in the consent decree to thousands of square miles in a subsequent lawsuit brought by the federal government.
Schnitzer Steel Industries has agreed to a multi-million dollar settlement after allegations that an Asian subsidiary paid bribes to the steel mill managers in China and South Korea. The Schnitzers are one of Oregon's most respected and powerful families. In the past few years, they've contributed millions of dollars to the University of Oregon, Oregon Ballet Theater, the Oregon Symphony, the Portland Art Museum, and more. Schnitzer Industries has agreed to pay a $7.7 million settlement after the allegations by the Securities and Exchange Commission were made. The commission said that the company's South Korean subsidiary gave improper cash payments and gifts to managers of government-owned steel mills in China between 1999 and 2004. SEC officials say the bribes were made to encourage business with Schnitzer. The company also paid bribes to privately owned steel mills in both China and South Korea.
With the midterm elections coming up next month, at least one organization is working to make sure young people vote. KABU Radio Youth Collective reporters Leslie Tuswell and Cecily Scott spoke last week with organizers from the Oregon Bus Project about how crucial the youth vote really is to the nation.
Hi, my name's Amanda, and I am an organizer for Building Votes with the Oregon Bus Project. We are the nonpartisan, nonprofit youth voter mobilization and registration wing of the Oregon Bus Project.
I'm Erica, and I am a Building Votes captain, which means that I just go out and volunteer and register as many people to vote as I can.
So what is your organization exactly about?
We're all about getting young people mobilized and energized and participating in the civic process. We specifically are just trying to get them registered and voting, and that's the most important thing that we do. Right now, we're trying to register 15,000 young people before the October 17th deadline. We're at about 13,000 as of Friday, and we're out there every day hitting the streets trying to make sure that young people are getting registered. We have about 500 volunteers that come out, which we call activated captains, which are trained and come out regularly to help us do voter registration. And then we have about 1,500 other prospects, which are people who've said they want to volunteer, but we just haven't gotten them to come out yet. One of the reasons why we're organizing here in Portland is because this is one of the more youth-dense parts of the state, most youth-dense, I should say. We also have an office in Eugene, but Northwest Portland is the most youth-dense part of Portland.
What would you say is the importance of youth voting?
Right now, youth have the smallest voice in our democratic process because they are the demographic which is voting the least. So right now, young people's issues aren't being talked about because young people aren't voting. When someone runs for political office either here in Oregon or in the nation and they go and look and see who's voting when they look at the voter file, the average voting age in the last election in Oregon was 62, and they can see that. So they talk about issues that resonate with 62-year-olds, not with young people. So we really need to get the young people energized in order to have an impact on young people's issues.
Even though I'm not old enough to vote, you know, I'm only 15, it's so important because I hear a lot of my friends who are old enough to be registered to vote and to be involved, you know, complain that they're not represented. But that's their responsibility. But I don't think that they realize that.
If the number of youth votes increased dramatically, how influential would that be on our next elections?
The candidates, you know, people in office would pay, you know, so much more attention to youth issues, and the youth would be so much more represented, and it would be a lot more balanced.
Right now, there are 50,000 unregistered 18 to 34-year-olds in Multnomah County alone. If we got those folks registered and voting, that could have a decisive impact on any Oregon election. Most elections here in Oregon are decided by a few thousand votes. So if you actually had the youth voting, they have immense power to actually change the way elections are decided here in Oregon. We really want anyone and everyone to get involved, and people of all ages. This isn't just a sort of a cause for young people. It matters for our democracy to have everyone's voices heard, to actually have a representative government of the people.
What exactly is Trick or Vote?
Trick or Vote is basically our huge Halloween canvas, although we do it a few days before Halloween. The idea is that you may be too old to trick or treat, but you are never too old to trick or vote. You get out there, you tell people you care, you knock on their doors and say, please, hey, remember to turn in your ballot. We don't care how you vote, we just care that you get involved and get engaged. And this year it's going to be at the Crystal Ballroom on the 29th. We're going to be meeting at 2 p.m. to canvas, and then around 7:30 we're going to have a huge concert with folks including Quiva and Pink Martini, March 4th, a bunch of other bands. If you canvas, you get in for free, and it's basically a big celebration of the work we've done that afternoon. Candidates Gone Wild is coming up on Monday, the 16th. We're asking folks to come out and meet us at the Roseland Theater at 6 and go and register voters at the bus malls and Pioneer Square. Basically, we call it street teaming. It's the day before the reg deadline. That's probably the best thing people can get involved in now.
Where would one sign up or go to sort of get involved with your program?
Definitely call our office if you want to get involved right now. We are trying to register 15,000 young people by the 17th of October, but after that we have 3 weeks of get out the vote, which is crucial. The first hurdle is getting people registered in the state, and the second hurdle is actually getting them voting. If you want to register for that, you can either go to our website, which is www.buildingvotes.org, and register there, and we'll get back to you, or you can call us at our office, which is 503-233-3018. And we would love to sign you up for an event.
Okay, great. Well, that was Amanda and Erica. Is there any closing things that you would like to say about getting our youth out there and voting?
It's definitely essential to get out there and vote and volunteer and be involved.
I'm Cecily Scott.
And I'm Leslie Tengwall, and we're with the KBOO News.
The Teaching Research Institute at Western Oregon University has received a $10.5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education. The money is to create a National Technical Assistance and Dissemination Center for Deafblind Youth. The Teaching Research Institute at WOU began operations this month. The award will be to fund the center of the center for 5 years, including offices at the Helen Keller National Center in New York, Hilton Perkins in Massachusetts, University of Tennessee, and the Deaf and Blind Link at WOU. Only 75 teachers in the United States are trained to work with both deaf and blind children. 95% of deaf and blind children have other disabilities.
The Coast Guard says ConocoPhillips has agreed to pay a $2.3 million fine for an oil spill in Puget Sound. The federal fine follows a state maximum $540,000 fine last week by the Washington Ecology Department. The tanker Polar Texas spilled 1,000 gallons of crude oil in October of 2004 in Dalco Passage. The oil fouled the beaches on Vashon and Morey Islands and cost $2.2 million to clean up. The federal penalty covers cleanup costs plus $80,000 fine under the Clean Water Act. The tanker had just delivered Alaska crude oil to a refinery in Tacoma and was taking on ballast water when residual oil from the tanker was released. The tanker has since been decommissioned.
Oregonians have until tomorrow at 5 p.m. to register for the November 7th elections. The easiest way to register is to download a voter registration form from the Secretary of State's website and take it to your county elections office, as it is probably too late to mail it in. You must live in Oregon, be a U.S. citizen, and be 18 years old by election day. After the registration deadline, there are three weeks until the November 7th election. During that period, volunteers and interest groups will do everything possible to surprise pollsters who are predicting a low voter turnout in Oregon this fall. In the May primary, only 39% of Oregon's registered voters can cast ballots. The turnout was barely 25% for voters in their 20s and 30s.
The American Civil Liberties Union is holding its annual membership conference in Washington, D.C. In what has been a turbulent time for civil liberties in the United States, one of the things they aren't highlighting is an abuse of power is the surveillance of anti-war protesters around the country. And as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, last week they received proof that such surveillance was going on.
Kurt Hordinsky is a student at University of California, Santa Cruz. He is a member of Students Against War, and his group has been placed on a military-monitored government surveillance list. Kurt describes one of the protest actions the government monitored.
The counter-recruitment action at a career fair that happened on campus. We had basically a demonstration of around 300, 200 people. That came and, you know, peacefully confronted the military recruiters who were signing up students at the career fair.
COT is a member of one of a dozen organizations that label themselves as peace groups, whose actions have been watched closely by the government. Another is the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker group that promotes nonviolence. Michael McConnell is the regional director in Chicago, Illinois.
Both events, the one in Akron and the one in Springfield, Massachusetts, dealt with military recruitment offices, and they were going to be peaceful protests at both places.
Both groups became aware of the government monitoring through a report by NBC News last December. The release of documents under a Freedom of Information request last week is the confirmation they sought. The Pentagon obtained the email communications of the peace groups from the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and the local police in 2004 and 2005. The Pentagon determined the credibility of the source and their threat. They then would place the group on the Talon watch list. Talon is a government database of domestic threats of treason or terrorism shared between government agencies. But critics say peace groups have no right to be on that list. Brittany Benowitz is with the Center for National Security Studies. She compares this to the domestic monitoring of peace groups and civil rights organizations in the 1960s and 70s.
The idea was that you never knew who was part of some sort of international communist conspiracy. Therefore, you had to investigate even peaceful groups to see if they were connected. That's the exact same thing that they're doing now with the Quakers and the veterans groups and the gay rights activists. They're saying, we have the right to collect information on them to see if they have links to terrorism.
In the 1970s, Congress passed the Privacy Act, which was supposed to limit government monitoring. Civil liberties advocates say the expanded powers of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security to monitor Americans violates Americans' privacy. And Brittany Benowitz says the expansion of domestic intelligence to the military further endangers that privacy.
Congress hardly knows what DOD is doing. I mean, DOD's budget of however many billion dollars a year, Congress, it's nearly impossible for them to know everything the Department of Defense is doing. Indeed, there have been amendments to recent DOD appropriations where they ask the Department of Defense to tell them everything that they're doing in the name of intelligence gathering. It's hard to describe how Byzantine the whole process is and how hard it is to get a handle on what they're doing. And that's very different from the FBI, which is subjected to rigorous oversight by the Congress, or it needs to be more rigorous, but it's totally different than what's going on with the military.
Major Patrick Ryder, a spokesperson for the Pentagon, says the database still exists to track suspected domestic terrorism activity, but clearer policies were implemented soon after the first news reports in December of 2005.
So what it's doing is it's giving you more insight into what some of the questionable information was in that database. But those kinds of things have since been removed from the database, and policies and procedures have been put in place to prevent that kind of information from going in the database.
But the expansion of government surveillance in the name of security has been a contentious issue in all three branches of government. Congress spent this year attempting to legislate how the president can proceed in the wiretapping of Americans. Two leading bills that would greatly expand the president's powers failed to pass through Congress. And the administration has been active in persuading members of Congress to support its surveillance activities. And in the judiciary, a federal judge in Detroit found the program illegal and unconstitutional, but appeals by the government are being reviewed. The ACLU has not received all the government information collected on the peace groups. They could write an appeal for the Department of Homeland Security to release its portion of documents. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A Florida judge is threatening to fine the state's Department of Children and Families for failing to serve mentally ill inmates. Roxanne Escobales reports from Tampa.
The Florida Department of Children and Families, or DCF, is spending $6.8 million to add 84 beds for people deemed mentally ill by the courts. But judges in the county jails where the insane and incompetent end up say that those efforts are not enough. Under state law, the Florida DCF has 15 days to find beds for mentally ill patients who would otherwise be sent to jail. But a lack of resources has left over 315 mentally ill inmates who should be in state care deteriorating behind bars, with over 250 of them waiting longer than the 15-day limit. Experts such as Pinellas County Jail Medical Director Dr. Tim Bailey say that the stressful environment of jail only exacerbates mental disorders.
They might go into acute crisis, or maybe become psychotic, or just get worse.
In Bailey's jail, one mentally ill inmate gouged out his eye while waiting to be transferred. A judge in that county threatened to fine the DCF $1,000 each day an inmate who needs care spends in the jail over the mandated limit. The DCF says it needs more time and more money to add the necessary beds. For Free Speech Radio News in Tampa, I'm Roxanne Escobales.
The former head of the Food and Drug Administration will plead guilty to lying about selling stocks of companies the agency regulates. Lester Crawford spent a year as acting head of the FDA. But just 2 months after officially getting the job, he abruptly quit in September of last year without giving a reason. According to the Justice Department, a government ethics official asked Crawford about what stocks he owned in several companies under FDA regulations. Crawford sent an email answering that he'd sold shares in two firms, even though authorities say he or his wife still had them. Also, while charging a government obesity panel, the Crawfords allegedly owned thousands of dollars worth of soda in snack food giant PepsiCo. His lawyer says Crawford will plead guilty tomorrow to two misdemeanors.
Civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart was sentenced today to 28 months in prison. She was sentenced on terrorism charges for helping a client who plotted to blow up New York City landmarks communicate with his followers. Stewart could have faced up to 30 years in prison. She was convicted in 2005 of providing material support to terrorists. The charges stem from Stewart's release of a statement by Omar Abdelrahman, a blind Egyptian sheik sentenced to life in prison after he was convicted in plots to blow up five New York landmarks and assassinate Egypt's president. Prosecutors have called the case a major victory in the war on terrorism, but Stewart's supporters see her as relatively light sentence as a victory.
The Missouri Supreme Court has struck down the state's new voter identification law. If it had stood, voters would have been required to show a photo ID at this fall's elections. Today's 6-1 ruling upholds a lower court judge's finding that the law was an unconstitutional infringement of a person's right to vote. Supporters claimed the ID requirement was needed to prevent voter fraud and increase confidence in the election process.
Democratic challengers in some of the closest U.S. Senate races tapped a fundraising vein that supplied them with money to compete against better-financed opponents. Candidates in most House and Senate races are also receiving help from the national parties, who help supplement campaign spending with party ad buys, polls, and direct mail.
Less than a month before Election Day, a politically connected coin dealer in Toledo, Ohio, went on trial today in a scandal that has rocked Ohio's Republican Party. Tom Noe is accused of stealing more than $2 million from a fund for injured workers and spending it on his business and renovating his home in the Florida Keys. Noe was a top GOP fundraiser who gave more than $100,000 to Republicans, including President Bush and Governor Bob Taft, during the 2004 campaign. He is charged with corrupt activity, theft, money laundering, and forgery. If convicted, he could get up to 10 years in prison on the corrupt activity charge alone. In a different case, Noe pleaded guilty earlier this year to funneling $45,000 to Bush's reelection campaign. He was sentenced last month to more than 2 years in federal prison. The trial is expected to last at least 6 weeks through the November 7th election.
Today, the FBI raided the homes of Pennsylvania Republican Representative Kurt Weldon's daughter and a close friend. The agency is investigating whether the congressman improperly helped the pair win lobbying and consulting contracts. Agents searched four locations in the Philadelphia area and two in Jacksonville, Florida. The congressman's home and his offices were not among the locations searched. Weldon called the investigation politically motivated and called the timing suspect. Weldon, who is locked in a tight re-election bid and has clashed with the Bush administration, denied wrongdoing and said that he gave his daughter no special help. Weldon is regarded by some as a foreign policy expert. Last year, he went on record alleging a secret military unit called Able Danger using data mining to link four September 11th hijackers to Al-Qaeda more than a year before the attacks. A Pentagon report rejected the idea.
And the current time is 5:37. Tonight, we're asking for you to become a member of KBOO Community Radio. Please make a pledge by calling 503-232-8818 or 877-500-KBOO. Time now to go to Lisa and Celeste.
Huh, I'm sitting here thinking, Congressman Weldon alleged data mining took place before 9/11, and sure enough, now his office is being raided. I don't know, Celeste. Anyway, yeah, that's right. We're here talking about the news. We're passing the
hat
for KBOO.
We're passing the hat, and we're asking you, do you have your subscription to KBOO? Do you? We know you listen. We know you enjoy it. But we're wondering if you knew that the phone number to get us here in the city was 503-232-8818. Now, we have a relatively modest goal, as goals do for this segment. We're only trying to reach $350. So what I figure that is if you want to pledge, you want to become a new member or a renewed member, that's just $5 a month on the EFT, and we just need six people to call in and do that.
I like to recommend that people give 1 hour's wage.
per month.
All right.
And that way, if you're making minimum wage, if you're making $7.50, that equals like $85 a year. And I'm just putting that out there that when you think of it that way, 1 hour's wage a month, you know, it's a myth that rich people give the most money to charity in this country. Actually, low-income people, statistics show low-income people give more money to charity than rich people do. But if you give an hour's wage a month at KBOO, I'm telling you, when you're at your job and you're suffering and you want to go home and it's all miserable, you can say to yourself, I'm going to do my KBOO hour right now.
Right now.
I'm telling you, it makes a difference.
503-232-8818
is the number to call.
1-877-500-KBOO. That's right. Make the call. And if you're online, if you're not even in Oregon, it's www.kboo.fm and choose the Join Now button.
Yeah, also people come in person to 20 Southeast 8th. It's in Portland, Oregon, half block south of Burnside, 20 Southeast 8th. Hey, you know what, Celeste? We were talking about telling people what they could get all year round with their membership card.
Oh, yes.
When you give your money, 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-KBOO. When you give your money, you're not just chucking cash at a radio. You're not just chucking cash at a box. You're actually committing. You're investing. And in return, you get a card in the mail. It's got your name on it. You become a card-carrying member of KBOO.
I got my card.
I do, too. And my friend Emily Young laminates hers. She was the one that showed me that when you take that card to the businesses that are listed right there in our program guide, you get that once a month, those businesses give you discounts all over the Willamette Valley. And the thing is, you might think, oh, come on, that's kind of like, you know, it's like I'm mooching or something. But every time Emily pulls out her card at our favorite bagel shop on Northeast Fremont Street, she pulls out that card at coffee shops. She pulls out that card at businesses that renovate your house. I swear to God, the people smile and start chatting with you about their favorite KBOO show.
You think I ought to tell them a few of the places?
I think you should.
Well, check this out. Since we're talking about news and public affairs, how about Wrigley Cross Books?
Ooh, I like that place.
10% off.
It's in Northeast Portland.
Okay. Laughing Horse Books.
5%. Oh, I really like that place. That's
Southeast. That's right.
Books.
Absolutely. That's books. Okay. What if all of this news and all of this behind the scenes shenanigans has really caught you with the fever to get out with a camera and to do some videography? How about Video Minds Video? That's an opportunity to get some editing or taping of special effects web design. 15% off. Or maybe it's really giving you a headache and too much tension. How about Common Ground Wellness Center?
Oh, yeah.
$10 off annual membership.
You know what I like about looking at that list, Celeste? Because, again, sometimes when people are asking you to contribute, it feels like you're just chucking money at a box, right?
Right.
But when you join KBOO, you become part of the KBOO community. You get the right to vote in our elections.
Mm-hmm.
You get the chance to vote. We just had a bylaws election. And you know what? It was kind of a mixed return. The people spoke, right?
The people spoke.
When you join these other radio stations, not that I'm knocking them, you don't get that right, dude. You don't get any say in how the station is run. But, I mean, I'm just putting it to you. We need people to call right now.
We need them to call. The phone needs to ring. We have people here poised and ready to take your call and to tell you about the wonderful thank you opportunities that we can present to you besides this fabulous programming. 1-877-500-5266. That's 1-877-500-5266. For all of our friends that live out in Hood River, or maybe they're in Scappoose, or maybe they're in the Dalles, or any of our outlying friends, McMinnville, White Salmon, that's in Washington. You listen?
Washington
and
is
now
a
you
utopia.
Can become a member.
Yeah, I love Washington State.
Oh,
we make a point of having news about Washington State in our broadcast because I find that the daily newspaper, The Oregonian, does not cover things that are going on in Washington.
No, it doesn't.
Democrats are in charge of the whole state, and they're doing all kind of really incredible things that we need to be watching.
Oh, you know, I just went up and visited reentry programs, and you know they have one of the leading reentry programs in the country.
That's when our friends and neighbors and relatives get out of incarceration and
come home.
It's about come home. So, you know, we're ready to come home back to the news broadcast. We're going to go back to Lisa and Mike for the last few minutes of the broadcast, and then we're going to come back and give you another chance to contribute to KBOO. But the number to call one more time, Celeste,
503-232-8818 in the metro area. Outside, 1-877-500-5266. Join now.
And now back to Lisa Lewis and Mike Munkvold live in studio 2.
Thanks, guys. The current time is 544, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Corporate America is fast implementing a two-tiered retirement system. A platinum-level plan for the top executives and a dirt-level plan for all of you riffraff below. There's even a term for the platinum pensions reserved for the corporate elite. Top hat plans, they're called. But while the CEOs are feathering their nests with multi-million dollar annual pension payments, they're working double time to destroy the retirement nest eggs of millions of their rank-and-file workers. Leading this pension-busting movement is the Business Roundtable, a lobbying group made up of the CEOs of America's 400 largest and richest corporations. The Roundtable wails that its members simply can no longer be expected to pay the middle-class pensions that they negotiated, supposedly in good faith, with workers. Roundtable members say that workers must, quote, take responsibility for their own retirement accounts rather than expecting the corporation to come through for them. The Business Roundtable is also leading another mingy effort to downsize the golden years of America's working class. It has been an enthusiastic backer of George W.'s push to privatize our Social Security system. The top honcho of the Roundtable has groundly declared that its members will spend what it takes to switch Social Security to private pension accounts. The CEOs want everyone's retirement to be at the mercy of the market, except theirs, of course. Consider such Roundtable members as Home Depot, IBM, ExxonMobil, Pfizer, Coca-Cola, Prudential, and GE. The CEOs of these giants are to get corporate guaranteed pension payments of more than $2 million a year. This is Jim Hightower saying, the attitude of these CEOs is summed up by ExxonMobil. Its executive suite at corporate headquarters is known as the God Pod. To keep track of the hypocrisy of these false gods and to help bring them down to earth, go to www.paywatch.org.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 p.m. following this newscast. And at 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tomorrow's weather in Portland and the Columbia Gorge, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning and highs around 60 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Israel's president, Moshe Katsav, did not attend the opening of Israel's parliament today following police recommendation to charge him with sex crimes. The police have recommended that the president be charged with a variety of crimes, including rape and sexual assault of women who worked in his office over a number of years. The police are also recommending Katsav be charged with fraud and betraying the trust of Israelis. If the prosecutor follows these recommendations, these will be some of the most serious charges ever leveled against any Israeli head of state. Iris Mackler reports from Jerusalem.
Just hours before the opening of the winter session of Israel's parliament, Israel's president, Moshe Katsav, cancelled his plans to attend. He'd already stated that he wouldn't give the customary presidential address, but he stayed away after lawmakers threatened to remain seated or to walk out when he entered. The Speaker of Israel's Parliament, Dalia Itzik, greeted a former president when she opened the winter session Monday. She says she accepted President Katsav's decision not to attend, but warned against sentencing him before a court process has begun. It's impossible to say that I feel comfortable with the police recommendations, but we also have to be careful. It's not our task to pass judgment on the president, she says. In moments of crisis like this, a democracy is measured by its restraint. This is the latest installment in a sexual scandal swirling around President Katsav that has been making headlines in Israel for weeks. First, one woman came forward to complain of sexual harassment when she worked as the president's office manager. Then while police were investigating these allegations, 9 more women came forward. They also complained of sexual harassment by Katsav over a number of years, during his term as president, and also before when he was a member of parliament. Things came to a head Sunday night, when Israeli police recommended charging Katsav with a series of crimes, including the rape of 2 women. They also recommended charging him with sexual harassment, as well as threatening witnesses to prevent them from talking to police about this case. The police also recommend charging Katsav with fraud and breach of trust crimes, alleging that he used public money to buy presents for his friends and colleagues. Yael Bala is the director of a Jerusalem foundation which defends the victims of sexual abuse. Hers is one of a number of women's groups that have been picketing the president's home since the allegations first emerged last month. Our views haven't changed. We're asking the president to step aside while the investigation takes place, says Bala. And now other groups are joining us, including members of the parliament and members of the public. Katsav denies the allegations and strongly maintains his innocence. He dismisses the female complainants as embittered former employees. He claims he's the victim of a witch hunt by groups who want to destroy him, including members of the police. The police's recommendations to charge are without precedent in Israel's history. The police file has been sent to the Attorney General's office. A decision over whether to charge the president will be made in the next few weeks. His lawyer says the president will resign if an indictment is laid. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 16th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mike Monkfold. Our assistant producer is Ross Egan. Our AP Wire editor is Jill Severson. Special thanks to reporters Leslie Tuswell, Cecily Scott, Eduardo Tierra, Chris Andre. Our engineer is Jeff Lovell. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Mike Monkfold. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7:30, it's Joe Uris and Abe Proctor with the Abe and Joe Show. They'll host a debate with the candidates for Multnomah County Commissioner, District 2, Jeff Cogan, and Lou Frederick. At 9, it's a special extended interview with George Lakoff, professor of linguistics at Berkeley, and author of numerous books, including Don't Think of an Elephant, Thinking Points, and Who's Freedom? At 10, hear from computer science professor Avi Rubin, author of Brave New Ballot, The Battles to Safeguard Democracy in the Age of Electronic Voting. At 10:30, Stage and Studio features Elizabeth Burnett, the executive director of Portland Arts and Lectures, with a look at the current series. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Coming up tomorrow, we'd like to remind you that we're in the midst of a KBOO Community Radio Fall Membership Drive, and we're asking for your continued support. Please make a pledge by calling 503-232-8818 or 877-500-KBOO. Good night.
Right on. Good night. And do please make a pledge of support. Huh, Celeste? I'm Lisa.
Absolutely.
I'm here with my friend Celeste. We're passing the hat for KBOO, but if somebody doesn't start calling, things are going to happen. Or things are going to not happen. I can't decide.
We might have to take to the streets.
503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-KBOO.
Now, we talked about so many good reasons about the programming, so many good things about the business partners at KBOO. We've talked so much about all of the wonderful things that our programming does to keep you alert, informed, and engaged. But you have to close that loop. You're not wholly engaged, you're not wholly alert, and you're not wholly informed if you're not supporting the very folks that bring you this news and information. There's a big gap missing, and it's you. So I tell you what, here is the special invitation from the bottom of our hearts to you to join KBOO, 503-232-8818. I'll say it again slowly because I know you're probably in traffic or you're cooking or, you know, you're doing some woodworking and you got that piece of wood turning on the lathe. Here it is. I'll slow it down. 503-232-8818. We need you engaged wholly, but we also want you to be engaged in a meaningful fashion. So when you make that pledge, when you become a new member or a renewed member, we'll take some time out to tell you what kinds of thank yous that we have for you. Mm-hmm. But it's not just for the Portland metropolitan area. Our news and information is not just in terms of the metro area or the region or the state. Oh, my goodness, no, not even nationally. We're a global entity.
It's no question about that, actually. Through our subscription to Free Speech Radio News, which we get through Pacifica News Network, we actually have reporters on the ground all over the world. And you know that if you listen to this broadcast, that stuff's not free. We actually have to pay for that, and we want you to pitch in some of your coins to make that happen. 503
yes, defray the cost.
232-8818. And also, you know, here's the thing, we're sitting over here, we're slaving over hot microphones, we just need to know that we're not alone.
That's,
I mean,
right.
Come on. 503, it's outside the Portland area, 1-877-500 KBOO.
That's right, KBOO.
And we're offering a few books. We have all these happy gifts to give you when you join. My favorite, actually, is News Junkie. It's the memoir by investigative reporter Jason Leopold, one of the reporters who broke the Enron story. He was the truthout.org reporter that covered the whole thing with Karl Rove, who was dragged before a grand jury 5 times. Actually, Jason Leopold's also mentioned in Project Censor 2007, his story about how Halliburton sold nuclear technological secrets to Iran is the number 2 most censored story for 2007. And his book, News Junkie, is completely readable. It's a $75 minimum pledge. Dude, 75, that's like $6.50 a month. I mean,
that's all it is.
I just want to put this out there. If you've ever listened to KBOO, you've heard about an author, a book that you think is great. You're thinking to yourself, you know what? I wish I could buy KBOO a half rack of beer. That's like how much that is, dude. That's hardly any money at all.
That's it.
503-232-8818. And actually, tonight's news broadcast, we front-loaded that with activism information. I mean, we take pride in issues, activism, and politics. That's our niche, and that's what we can do that, say, our brothers and sisters at Oregon Public Broadcasting cannot
do. I'm not really good for correcting folks, but I kind of do want to correct that just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We also need to make sure that people understand we're relevant.
Oh, yeah.
We're extremely relevant. What do we mean by that? We're not missing those things that the mainstream moguls let fall out of their mouths. No, no crumbs are left here. You get it all. Absolutely. So that means any story that maybe just didn't rise to the occasion, we went back to the back and we dug out all of that information. And you were just telling me about one of them today.
There's all kind of stories, actually. In the coming year, we're going to do a lot more investigative projects because we started doing that this year, first time in the history of the KBOO Evening News, or the Morning News for that matter, doing investigative stories. We did a project around Oregon's war economy. We're also working on some Pacifica News Network pre-election coverage for the series that Pacifica runs called Informed Dissent. And our piece is all about corporate corruption. Yes. I actually just interviewed Grover Norquist a couple weeks ago. So that's going to be coming out here. But we need your help to support this. I mean, do you
care
or not?
Do
503-232-8818.
1-877-500-KBOO.
KBOO. And we're located at 20
Southeast 8th.
Half block south of Burnside in Portland, Oregon. It's
That's right.
On
the
a
little
bus
blue
line.
Building with the giant satellite dish, just like an ear listening to the cosmos.
Indeed. And also putting it out. We're hearing it and we're putting it out.
That's right. And speaking of putting it out, let's thank the folks who are our business partners who have also put it out. First is Box Lunch Online. I almost said Bunch of Lunch, but BoxLunchOnline.com and Acapulco's Gold at 2610 Northwest Vaughn.
They fed us today.
Yes, they did. They are our partners. If the businesses find the value in coming together with KBOO, surely you can too. They have just as much a stake in their future as you do in yours.
Hey, here's something I want to toss out there. Remember the Boo Ball?
Don't
you miss the Boo Ball?
The big Boo Ball.
I fell in love with my beloved sweetheart at the Boo Ball. That's when we knew we were going to be together forever. And it kind of went away, but check this out. It's kind of coming back, dude.
Ooh.
October 31st. We're calling it now. My friend Chihito, he's putting it together. He's calling it the Boo Bash. He wants it to be unique. He wants it to be special, 21st century. So that's Halloween night.
Well, if he's going to make it 21st century, then that means it's the Boolapalooza.
Well, and for Pete's sake. But listen, I mean, we give. Now we have to ask for some. We have to ask for some money from you to put in the front of the machine.
We need you to close that circle. That's right.
503.
It's a partnership.
Yeah, 503-232-8818 or toll free 1-877-500-KBOO. 5266. I was going to zig while she zagged.
Yeah.
You know, literally in like 5 seconds, we're supposed to go to Labor Radio, which is really actually an unbelievably hot show, a collective of people who themselves are a part of the organized labor movement.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's how, you know, when you look at KBOO, we're communities that stand on each other's shoulders. And we need the people who are right in the middle of those shoulders to kick in so that we don't collapse. 503-232-8818. Ben, are you ready for Labor Radio?
That's right. Then KBOO listeners who are not yet members, invest more, not less, in your community.
Thanks to all who called.
Hi, this is Ern Hood with another historical vignette from the KBOO Attic of Dusty Memories.
Don't miss the DIY Portland special, DIY Radio. Thursday, October 19th at 10 a.m., you'll hear the voices of radio activists from all over. And we'll take a look back at our own history.
On the radio.
Well, I think radio can do a lot to change the world.
Radio can change the world.
Radio can change the world.
All this and some awesome thank you gifts when you tune in to the DIY Portland special, DIY Radio, Thursday, October 19th at 10 a.m.
Attention nonprofit job seekers, Portland's largest networking forum, Idealist.org's Nonprofit Career Fair, will be held at Portland State University on October 19th. This is an opportunity to connect directly with representatives from as many as 60 to 70 organizations in one space about current and future employment, internship, and volunteer opportunities. Additionally, free information sessions offering nonprofit career advice will be available to all job seekers. The fair will be held in the ballroom on the third floor of the Smith Memorial Student Union at Portland State University on October 19th from 11 to 3 p.m. For more information, go to idealist.org/fairs. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Good evening. You are listening to Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley. And also streaming live at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, Kevin Card, and tonight we have a great show exploring that holiest of workers' rights, the right to strike. In particular, we're going to look at a seminal event involving the right to strike, which occurred 25 years ago when, on August 3rd, 1981, more than 12,000 members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO, walked off their jobs directing the nation's air traffic for the Federal Aviation Administration. Defying laws that prohibited federal workers from striking, the PATCO members were attempting to force the government to negotiate over their demands for a shorter work week and higher pay. Then President Ronald Reagan responded with an ultimatum that if the controllers did not return to work within 48 hours, he would fire them. When more than 11,000 strikers decided to test Reagan's resolve, they lost both their jobs and their union. Joining us tonight to talk about the PATCO strike and its long-term effect on the labor movement in general will be Joseph McMartin. Joseph McMartin is McCartin is an associate professor at Georgetown University. He's an expert on 20th century U.S. labor, social, and political issues, and is currently working on a book about the PATCO strike and its ramifications for the labor movement. Joseph McCartin, welcome to Labor Radio.
Kevin, it's a pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you. And also joining us is Bob Bussell, director of the Labor Education Research Center at the University of Oregon. The Labor Education Research Center serves as a link between the labor community and the faculty and resources of the university. LERC is primarily directed to public service and outreach to the labor community through its education programs and training for leadership in the workplace. Bob Bussell, welcome back to Labor Radio. I guess Bob's not here. Okay, Bob will be. So let's talk, Joseph.
Sure.
Okay, can you give us a quick history of the PATCO strike?
Sure, Kevin. Well, let me go back a little bit just to set for your listeners some of the context for this. Unions really took off in the federal government in the 1960s following an executive order issued by President Kennedy, which allowed collective bargaining in the federal service, which he issued in 1962. PATCO grew out of several years of organizing after that executive order, and the union was in fact formed in 1968. It was ultimately recognized as the union that represented the nation's air traffic controllers by 1973, and the air traffic controllers, of course, work for a federal agency known as the Federal Aviation Administration. It successfully negotiated contracts with the federal government shortly after its founding and again in the mid-70s. But when the contract that the union negotiated in 1978, which proved to be its last one, expired in 1981, the union ended up going out on strike. Now, at that time, the president was Ronald Reagan. He'd been elected, of course, in 1980. Ironically, PATCO had endorsed Reagan in 1980 also, and I could go into that more in a few minutes. But I'll just say that PATCO had felt that Reagan would deal fairly with them, as they saw it, on demands to shorten their work week and improve their compensation in this high-stress job of directing air traffic. But when the administration fell short of what PATCO had been seeking, in fact far short of that, the union went out on strike on August 3rd, 1981. And as you said in your introduction, the workers did not have the legal right to do that. However, there were many precedents of strikes by federal workers in the past, including one in 1970 by many postal workers, thousands of them in fact, and in fact, an earlier sick-out strike by air traffic controllers also in 1970. In the past, no administration had responded to a strike by federal workers by firing them in a blanket manner, even though the law had allowed for it. But in 1981, Reagan issued an ultimatum to the controllers, basically said you have 48 hours to return to the jobs that you have struck. If you do not, you will be permanently replaced. And he did carry out that threat. More than 12,000 people struck. Only a few hundred went back before the 48 hours elapsed, and the rest were fired and replaced.
And joining us is Bob Bussell, the director of the Labor Education Research Center. Are you there, Bob?
Yes, I am, Kevin.
And you remember this event also?
Yes, actually, personally, in the sense that I was working for the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers at the time, and remember doing numerous rallies and demonstrations in New Jersey, particularly around Newark Airport, in support of the air traffic controllers there.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here. I hate to do this to you guys, but it is our pledge drive here at KBOO. And it's our chance where we come to our membership twice a year, our listeners, to ask them to help support this radio station to keep Labor Radio on the air. We'll be right back with Joseph McCartan and Bob Bussell.
Excellent, excellent. And, you know, we might even want to try to engage them and talk about how important labor unions are right now. In this day and age of eroding wages and employee benefits and rights, what better opportunity to keep abreast of these changes than by being a member as well as a listener to KBOO. We do it all for you. We get behind the scenes. We bring you information to help set the environment, to let you know what's going on in terms of history, and then we bring you up to date with what's going on now. Keep you engaged, let you know what is going on that affects your dollar, what affects your opportunities, your benefits, your rights with your job. Anything that's news, we have here at KBOO. Pure and simple. But you know what? We need you to keep this kind of news and information intact on the air engaged. 503-232-8818 is the number here in the Portland metropolitan area to call and join now. We have a goal of $400, and we know that is accomplished easily. All we need is you. All we need is for you to call up and to make a pledge. Oh, you don't know how much to give? Let me give you a couple of examples here. If you want to pledge $120, that's only $10 a month. That's all. And you can do it with electronic funds transfer, which is a relatively painless way to make sure your giving continues. Your giving is uninterrupted, and your giving arrives in a timely fashion. So how about that? Or for all of you who really appreciate having a good living wage, give an hour's pay a month.
And this is Kevin here, Labor Radio host. And I like to say that during Pledge Drive, we give our listeners an opportunity to go from the working class to the owning class, right?
That's
because
right.
If you give your small monthly donation, if you give anything to KBOO, you become a part owner in this radio station. Where we have class conscious, we want you to move up in the world, be part of the owning class by calling that number, which is 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266, and move from the working class to the owning class. Join KBOO.
Are you a member of a union? If you're a member of a union, then you know how important it is to keep abreast of what's going on. Do you appreciate this opportunity to hear more about unions, about labor, about you? Hey, this show is on the air because we have someone who is dedicated. But, you know, this is a volunteer effort. The money that you send in supports the technology that's bringing you the phone calls. Or maybe it's supporting the technology that has my voice being transmitted from my vocal cords to your ear and to your consciousness, making you want to get up and go to that telephone and dial 1-877-500-5266. And if you do that, if you feel that need coming over you right now to become a member, to become a sustaining subscriber, tell you what, we have some wonderful thank you gifts when you become a member or you renew. Earth Democracy by Vandana Shiva. This is a boldly confronting book written on the Neoconservative Project for a New American Century, also known as PNAC. This world-renowned physicist and activist responds with her latest book, which she refers to as the People's Project for a New Planetary Millennium. You can get that or other gifts when you become a member, when you renew your membership, by calling 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266. If you're on the web, that's kboo.fm, and then hit the Join Now button.
And I believe there are special premiums for our friends who join online. And I know there are I know there's folks all around the country who are out there taking advantage of our streaming audio to listen to this program, and I appreciate that. So go ahead, go online, go to the Join Now at the KBOO website, and we'll be pleased. We're happy to have people from around the country join this radio station, and
it
happens
every
day.
Yeah, you'll be pleased if you join. Think about this. You work hard. You want some representation. Well, I tell you what, you can't do all the good work that your heart desires, but you can send your money out to do it. Your money will do a good job for you, and we'll be good to your money. We're good stewards. We're good stewards of the airways. We're good stewards of your money. We have about 10 people who work here. They work tirelessly. The rest of us, about 450 of us, are volunteers. We come in here because we care about you. We care about the message that needs to go out, that keeps us shored up, that keeps us encouraged to stay engaged and building a better society. But we need you. It's not a solo activity.
We have a very small goal of $400 we need to raise for this program. So
we need those phones ringing.
Reach down and grab your telephone and dial 503-232-8818 and join this experiment in labor radio that we have. Labor radio is the only live and local labor program in the area.
How long have you been doing it?
Every single Monday for probably, I think we've been on the air for nearly 10 years now.
10 years. That's got to be not only a record, but it's got to be worth something to you out there.
And we've had a lot of great people. We have a couple great folks. We got great people lined up for tonight that we want to get back to. So please call 503-232-8818, or if you're outside the Portland metropolitan area, that's 1-877-500-5266.
And we can make it with your help.
Now we're back to Labor Radio. Joe and Bob, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you for tolerating our pledge break there.
My pleasure.
Yeah, likewise.
You guys make a strong case there.
Well, we try to. You know, I think back to the old days of, you know, Studs Terkel, who invented the radio interview, and him talking about how there used to be labor reporters at every major newspaper in America. And we don't have that. We have a lot of business reporters, very few labor reporters.
That's right.
But let's get back to the PATCO strike. What do you think made the PATCO workers think they would be successful when they walked off their jobs 25 years ago?
Well, ironically, Kevin, one reason why they felt that they would be successful is they had gone toe-to-toe with the federal government once before. In March of 1970, about 2,500, close to 3,000 air traffic controllers staged a sick-out that lasted for about 18 days. They were threatened with firing, and indeed the then FAA administrator was determined to fire them. He argued that this was a job action in violation of the law, but in the end, the administration negotiated an end to that conflict. And, in fact, only one person out of the nearly 3,000 who participated in that strike was ultimately permanently replaced or fired. And that guy, it was sort of agreed by both sides, there needed to be one person singled out. He ended up being PATCO's chief organizer in the 70s. So they had fought before with the federal government. And they had found, in fact, in a series of confrontations that the FAA tended not to deal with them very fairly unless they were prepared to show the FAA that they in turn meant business. So one reason why I think that they went into the strike in 1981 thinking that they could win was that they had been through this before, or at least many of the PATCO leaders had, and they felt that if they hung together in 1981, that there was no way that the government could replace all of them. And about 80% of them did vote to strike, and they felt that the system absolutely couldn't work. And ironically, when Reagan gave them a 48-hour ultimatum, many of them looked back at what had happened 11 years earlier when similar ultimatums were given, and they concluded that certainly that's what the government's going to say in public, but behind the scenes, they've got to negotiate their way out of this. So it was, in effect, a miscalculation, you might say, but one based on not erroneous reading of the past history of labor relations with the federal government.
Well, was this strike more about money or about working conditions?
Well, I think it was about both. You know, very clearly, controllers felt that they were underpaid because of, given the nature of the work that they did. They looked, for example, at pilots who earned two or more times as much as controllers, sometimes three or four times as much, and they felt that they had a similar sort of life and death sort of control over people's lives. One mistake could lead to a disaster. They, like pilots, had to train for years for their jobs, and they felt that they were underpaid. That was a key issue, but they also felt that the stress in their workplaces needed to be dealt with, in part by shortening the work week.
Yeah, that's one of the things I recall most distinctly from that period, Joe, was that while the money certainly mattered, that many of the air traffic controllers spoke quite eloquently about the level of job stress. And the fact is, I recall that many of them had difficulty actually making it to the prescribed retirement age because of that stress.
Now, Bob, you're absolutely right, Bob. And one of the key things among the controllers was the idea that so many of the people that they worked with never made it to full retirement, often had to go out on disability. So they really felt something had to change about the job, and they were, in fact, willing to even risk their jobs in order to bring about that change.
Well, I guess this pushes towards one of the fundamental things that unions bargain on all the time. It's not always about wages and benefits, but it's really a lot about control of the workplace, about who does the work and when they do it and how long they have to do it.
Absolutely right. And in the case of PATCO and the FAA workplaces, say in the 1970s, that's really what made PATCO into a union. Actually, the people who founded it in 1968 didn't use the word union in the title of the organization. It was the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, and they weren't quite sure that they wanted a union in the traditional sense. But what they found was that persistent battles between management and controllers in the workplace over how the work ought to be done had led to such a level of conflict that it kind of created a union consciousness among the PATCO activists, and they became more of a union through the 70s to the point where they were actually ready to strike.
And I think that happened in other instances in the public sector as well. There was certainly some residue from the 1960s that was left over. And as I recall, I think a fair amount of the PATCO workers, were they veterans, Joe?
Almost 90%, Bob, in the 70s had come out of the military. And that's where most of them had first been exposed to the job of controlling air traffic. So you're right.
Yeah, and I think there's a level of certainly esprit and discipline and, you know, a sense of organization. Some of those sorts of things follow over, I think, from folks in the military. So I think there's a larger context, you know, as far as what was going on among public employees and their increasing unwillingness to take the kind of treatment from management that had been coming down, you know, whether it was teachers, postal workers, or in this case, air traffic controllers.
I think you're absolutely right. One thing that the controllers I interview on this project talk about quite a bit, for example, is that the FAA actually had a dress code. Even though most of these folks worked in darkened rooms, huddled over radar screens, and really no one in the public ever saw them, they were, in the early period of this struggle, required to show up and wear white shirts and ties and would actually be docked pay and sent home if they even wore something other than a white shirt. So it was that level of conflict over treatment by management that actually helped to create the union, really.
Well, I would guess that a number there, that the management probably came from the military also, to run an organization like that, and they're used to giving orders.
That is exactly right, Kevin, and that was a key part of what went wrong within the FAA. It was run in a sort of military model, and I think what Bob said a minute ago is really important. I think something crucial happened in the 60s in this country as the movements for civil rights, feminism, and other things really began to gain strength, and that was that people began to to look for a more humane kind of treatment. And what the controllers often found was that they were being dealt with as if they were children or, say, grunts being ordered around by superior officers. And that really began to rub them increasingly wrong.
Well, let's fast forward these 25 years and see what has happened, because you recently wrote an article about the day the strike died when you mm-hmm. talk about this particular incident. And what do you mean by that, Joe?
Well, what I was trying to call attention to in that was that since 1981, we've seen a dramatic decline in the ability of American workers to be able to strike successfully. The strike, historically has been one of labor's most important weapons. Unless workers can successfully withhold their labor, when push really comes to shove in a dispute, then their unions really don't have the power that they sometimes need to have to be able to advance workers' interests. In the period after World War II, the strike was a very healthy tool for American workers and unions, and that continued really through the 60s. From the end of World War II, say, until the mid-1970s, the U.S. averaged about 300 major strikes a year. That is, strikes that involved about 1,000 workers. So the strike was a healthy weapon, but that began to deteriorate over the course of the 70s, and then rapidly so after the PATCO strike, in part because employers began to fight back in the 1980s by following Reagan's example and permanently replacing workers that went out on strike. That was a new development. Even though by law employers could do that in many strikes, any strike that didn't involve, say, union recognition or unfair labor practices, but if it was a strike over wages, say, employers did have the right to replace strikers, even to keep those replacements on the job.
You think it had? Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Oh, no, I was just going to... I just actually pulled those stats before we came on, and
yeah,
it's just really noteworthy that, as Joe said, there were 200, 300 strikes a year pretty much from 1947 up until 81. In 81, there were 145. This involves 1,000 or more workers. It's never gotten above 100 since then. And if you look at the last, say, 3 or 4 years, 19, 14, 17, 22 strikes,
right,
barely involving, 100,000 workers. So it's one of those rare events, I think. I like to show this figure in labor. I don't like to show it, but I do show it in labor education classes, and people immediately go to 81, and it's just such a clear demarcation, which is, unusual historically.
Indeed, and really strikes dramatically plummeted then, and as Bob points out, they have declined to quite an enormous extent recently. In this century so far, we are averaging under 30, as Bob indicates. Now, that's less than one-tenth what the rate was in the 70s. So that shows you how much the strike weapon has sort of been taken away from workers and their unions in the years since 81. I think part of it has to do with the way Reagan legitimized this practice of permanent replacement. And employers began to do that in the 80s, and a series of strikes, many listeners may remember, strikes like that at International Paper or Hormel or
Phelps Dodge.
And those defeats really hurt.
Do you think that this also has to do with a couple things come to mind? The change in our jobs. I mean, the change in automation and stuff. Because I belong to the Letter Carriers Union. And in 1970, there was a wildcat strike that shut down the mail, the delivery of the mail in Manhattan. And in a number of places around the country, and it was very effective. We actually, Richard Nixon came to the, called up the head of our union and said, "What do you need?" And they drove a bargain in order to basically create the postal service that we have today.
That's right.
But at that time, it was a very manual thing. There's a famous picture of a National Guardsman standing at one of the places where we sorted our mail, and he had this look on his face like, I'd rather be at war than try to do this thing. But now, even with the traffic controllers, is their job much more automated than it was back then?
It is more automated. There's no doubt about that. And automation does, have some effect, I think, on this. By the way, your 1970 postal strike that you just mentioned, that was one of the things that PATCO had in mind in 1981. And they were hoping that just what happened for postal workers would happen for air traffic controllers. That is, that the FAA would be partially detached from the federal government, and they would get the right to bargain over their compensation. But, just to return to the question of automation, I do think it's important, but I think it's just one of a constellation of things. I think part of the reason why strikes have declined has to do also with the decline of manufacturing jobs. And the workers who'd been really effective at using the strike in, say, the 1950s were overwhelmingly in manufacturing. And so the decline of those jobs, I think, weakened not only unions, but their ability to strike. And I think another factor has to do with the changing nature of the global economy, where workers increasingly felt after the early to mid-80s that if they shut down their plant, it might just move.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, if you think correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think the most successful recent national strike was UPS in 97.
That's right, I think.
And what struck, no pun intended, what struck me during that event was I would get calls from reporters who just had no sense of a national strike. It was as if it had skipped a generation as far as people really having any understanding of what that was about. But it really was something that had been unheard of almost for a generation, the ability to actually have a successful national strike. There was an issue, the rise of part-time and temporary work that was easily dramatized. And of course, those workers could not that readily be replaced. But we haven't really seen anything equivalent of that, almost since PATCO, I think.
Bob, I think you're right, and I think the UPS strike stood out because it was successful in the face of so many others which had not been. The fact that those jobs couldn't be outsourced, I think, gave the workers a little bit more leverage. I think I'm just struck by your point about that the whole knowledge of a national strike sort of skipped a generation, and I think that there is something important that's happened, and labor's going to have to grapple with this, and that is that in the 1950s, say, when strikes were common, people knew what a picket line meant, and they knew that crossing a picket line was a grievous thing that they would not want to do if they cared about their neighbor, if they cared about the idea of collective bargaining or a union. And these, what you might call habits of solidarity, were very much inculcated in people, and people knew them and had first-hand experience with them. But now that the strike has become so rare, it's almost like labor will have to reteach a new generation about this tool.
Well, think about it, too. I mean, even in popular culture, after the football players' strike, and there were so many scabs that were used. I mean, it's admittedly a bit of an unusual type of occupational setting, but the fact that a movie called The Replacements, and that became the euphemism for scab, and that could be made and sort of popularized, and The Replacements or the scabs would look sympathetic, I think speaks to the point that Joe's mentioning about the decline in the sense of habits of solidarity. I know I had a colleague when I was in the labor education program at Penn State who was a son of an auto worker in Detroit, and he said we had pretty much a culture of striking in that industry, that months before the contract expired, we'd start saving money, gearing up, doing the things that we had to do. It's also a wonderful book that Joe's no doubt familiar with, and maybe Kevin as well, Striking Steel by Jack Metzger, which describes the 1959 steel strike and his father's role in it. And there's, again, very much that sense of a culture in a lot of the towns in the Midwest and the East Coast about what it meant to go on strike, and the sense that that was a legitimate thing to do, which now is much more in question.
Well,
I think that's right.
I hate to break this great conversation, but I need to wrap this up for another pledge pitch, but what do you think? Is the strike effectively gone? I mean, right now, most union contracts are settled at the bargaining table. And
I know my own union has binding arbitration. Do you think that is something in binding mediation and binding arbitration is the destiny of the labor movement right now?
Well, I wouldn't say the strike's gone completely, and I think that if unions don't recover at least the ability to threaten a strike, then I think it's going to be difficult to rebuild our ranks. I'm not arguing for, you know, a lot of strikes necessarily, but there needs to be some way of reviving this possibility, I think, if we're going to also reverse the decline of membership, because I think almost the two go hand in hand. And if we're going to convince workers who aren't in unions that it makes sense to join a union, we have to be able to demonstrate that being in a union and standing together can accomplish something, not just through arbitration, but if arbitration fails, through withholding labor, if nothing else works. So I don't think it's disappeared. I think its recovery is very important, though.
Yeah, I would just quickly say, you know, as we speak, there are nearly 15,000 Goodyear workers who are out on strike, and they had made concessions in their previous bargaining. Now the company is profitable again, or more profitable, and they feel as if it's time to get their fair share. So I agree with Joe that it certainly is not something I think that is prehistoric or going the way of the dinosaurs. On the other hand, it's not the easiest thing to do. But again, in certain circumstances, you take Hershey Foods in Pennsylvania just a few years ago. They had a 45-day strike and were relatively successful. So I think it takes a lot more, I guess, now than it once did, in the sense that just strictly withholding your labor, you know, walking the picket line, having the fire and folks walking around it and having the unfair signs, I think it requires a more comprehensive, sophisticated, broad strategy rather than simply withholding labor. That, I think, is a key difference to be successful in a strike nowadays. And I think we had a strike here locally, Joe, that's going to be talked about subsequently with a mental health center that I think was a textbook case in doing just that.
Well, Joseph McCartan, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight on Labor Radio. We're going to try to build a little worker solidarity by going out to Pledge Central and joining us. I'd like to have you back. When will your book on the Patco strike?
It's probably still a year or so away, Kevin, but I'd come back any time. It's a pleasure. It's also a pleasure to share this time with Bob. We've known each other for a long time. So.
Yeah, it was really, really nice to be on the wire with you, Joe. And I know a lot of others are really looking forward to your book.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
And we will be back with Leslie Frain, Executive Director of SEIU Local 503, and one of her workers, Colleen Sullivan, after this trip out to Pledge Central.
Actually, we're not Pledge Central. We're Membership Central here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. No apologies. I just want to make sure everybody is up to date and get on this page and get on your telephone. We're inching our way to our goal, but we need you. We need you to call in and to make a pledge at 503-232-8818. And when you do that, you'll connect to one of our eager volunteers who's just waiting to tell you how wonderful you are and how wonderful your connection with KBOO, your subscription to KBOO programming will be. We want to send out a thanks right now to renewing members Tom and John from Oregon. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for having faith in KBOO and staying connected. One of the things that we got out of the program, if you were listening, was that there's a decline in the habits of solidarity. Is that true? Is that you? Tell us it's not. Become a member. Consider solidarity with your community non-commercial radio station. What could that mean to you? Well, besides the fact that you get award-winning programming and programming that's relevant to the here and now and where you live, it also means that you sustain the opportunity to keep a commercial-free venture commercial-free. And that's really important. Do you have a local co-op that you shop at, maybe for your food? Do you perhaps live out in the parts of Oregon that have a People's Utility Corporation? You know, some things like that. These are solidarity movements. These are solidarity organizations in which people get together, they share their views or their needs, and they build a system that meets those needs or meets those views or helps expand those views. Oh, that's what you do with KABU. Are you the member of a labor union? I am. Are you a member of KABU? I am. So how about we change that decline? We stop that decline. We call it an incline, and we raise the bar, so to speak. Become a member of KABU. Support commercial-free, uncompromised radio. And why don't we have a little combination pitch here? Tell us a little bit about this program and why people should be willing to support it.
Well, people need to support this program because we've lost the voice of the working class in this country. You know, open up your major daily paper here in Oregon, and you're not going to read about the plight of workers. You're not going to read much about this stuff. We have a full business section of the paper. We do not have anything that addresses the ongoing struggles of working people in our community. So that's why we have Labor Radio. So if you can give us a call at 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266, you can keep this program on the air. We think it's essential for labor to have a voice here in this community, and for the past 10 years, we've been able to do this. We've been able to do it by bringing in a handful of volunteers who go out of their way to try and find hot topics and interesting people who are engaged in what's happening both locally and nationally in the labor movement, and bring it to KABU listeners every Monday for 1 hour. And that's pretty unprecedented around the country. You don't find there are some labor programs that are nationally broadcast, but there's nothing locally produced like this around the country. So give us a call at 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266 and let us know how much you value Labor Radio. Hey, there's a phone call. That's what we want to hear. Celeste, you came down here. You do a morning show.
Yes.
You were here early this morning.
Yes, I was.
And you just hung around because it's such a great place and
back after my job just to be supportive because the whole idea is this is a community venture. This is a team effort. And so we all get together and we kind of pull. We have to kind of model the behavior that we want everybody else to manifest. And so I come here to pull my fair share, and I try to encourage people to get engaged. And, you know, when they hear how important the show is to you, when they hear that passion in your voice, they're thinking, yeah, that's right. I am engaged. I am concerned about my job. I want to know a little bit about the history. This whole thing about PATCO is really relevant to me because one of my brothers is an air traffic controller. And they have lost a lot. They've lost salaries. They've lost some of their benefits. And so when you hear about this, you realize that no matter what your income level is, you're still a worker, and it's important to know who your allies are and to get together with those allies.
And you can get together with our allies by calling 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266 and remember, it's your chance to join the owning class by joining KBOO.
Oh, I love that. Join the owning class. What was that Bush said about making this an ownership society?
That's right.
One of the few right things he said.
You can be part of the ownership society by calling 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266. And shall we get back to Labor Radio?
Yes, let's do that.
Thank
and
you,
keep
Celeste.
The calls coming.
Thank you, Celeste. Well, we're going to get back to talking about strikes, and we're going to talk about a strike in particular, probably the most recent one we had here in the Portland area. And my next guest is Leslie Frayne, Executive Director of Service Employees International Union Local 503, at what, over 35,000 members, Leslie? SEIU Local 503 represents the largest group of organized workers in Oregon. Leslie, are you there? Leslie, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you.
And joining me in the studio is Colleen Sullivan, who worked at the Perry Center, which is the strike we're going to talk about. Leslie, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about SEIU Local 503. And,
sure. We represent close to 40,000 workers in Oregon, state workers, local government employees, home care workers, child care workers. And the particular workers who are involved in the strikes that we're going to talk about are folks who provide mental health services to troubled kids in Oregon, and they work for a private sector nonprofit agency. But what's interesting is almost all of the funding that they receive comes from the state. So it's a publicly funded service, but one that the state has contracted out as a way of saving money, largely at the workers' expense.
And that became part of the problem, didn't it?
Absolutely. Perry Center organized 6 or 7 years ago, and it's been a struggle ever since to get the compensation that these workers deserve for doing what is just incredibly important work, taking care of the most vulnerable kids in our society, kids with serious mental health problems, and many of them from very troubled families as well, who don't have a lot of things going for them, and our members there are the closest thing to family that many of them have, who help take care of them and give them the treatment that they need so that maybe they can function in society independently and to make the most of to treat their mental illnesses so that they can function independently. 5 years ago, they were paid less than $10 an hour, despite the fact that they were required to have college degrees. They have no retirement plan, but I think on, even more important than that, they faced an employer who really had never accepted the fact that its employees had decided that they wanted to have a union. So the issue that really drove the strike, it was partly about turnover, that we couldn't keep workers there because people couldn't afford to work there, but it was also based on a proposal that the employer made essentially break the union by moving some positions out of the union and by creating an open shop environment, the kind of union that we have in the South in this country, where the union is permanently weakened because some employees pay union dues and others get a free ride.
And your union represents primarily public sector workers in Oregon. And that has to affect your use of striking as a way to get management to the bargaining table.
Well, yes and no. And we've organized more and more private sector workers over the years. At this point, we represent 19 nursing homes, which are strictly private sector. But we've also had public sector strikes in this state. Our union has had two statewide strikes, one in 1985, one in 1997, where we had a statewide strike of public employees. We also had a strike at the Northwest Regional Educational Lab a number of years ago, and have had countywide strikes as well. So although we don't have a lot of strikes, I think we believe that it is important to have that weapon and to be willing to use that weapon in extreme cases, both so that workers who are faced with really dire circumstances have recourse, and also, frankly, we think it affects how other employers approach bargaining when they know that a union is willing to strike if necessary. They approach bargaining with, I think, a different attitude.
Well, Colleen, you were there when the Perry Center workers decided to band together and to strike. What was that like? What was the feeling among the workers that they actually got pushed so far that they would walk off the jobs and give up their livelihood?
Well, it was both a terrifying and incredibly inspiring experience. It certainly didn't happen overnight. It wasn't something we just woke up and said, I think it's time to strike. We had been pushed repeatedly over a number of years, farther and farther and farther. And as we saw management continuing to push us farther, we decided that it was time to take a stand, not just for us, not just for the kids that we took care of, but also for all working people in Portland and Oregon and in this country, really. And I think we did that.
And so what was the mood like when, you know, I just find it a pretty a difficult thing for workers in this economy to decide to just walk away from a steady job. Portland's not the easiest place in the world. No place is easy to find a job these days. It must have been, you know, what's it like to take a strike vote?
Well, there are a number of factors to consider. We were, as Leslie mentioned, some of the lower paid workers. We started at $8.86 an hour with a college education, so many of us were carrying very large student loan burdens. And frankly, we were living paycheck to paycheck at best, carrying other debts to make ends meet. So there was certainly the financial concern. And there was also the concern of the fact that we were caretakers, and a lot of people put a lot of pressure on us regarding our responsibility that we took very seriously. And So it was a terrifying process. We had to know that not only we were doing the right thing, we had to know exactly why we were doing it, and we had to know that we could count on each other and the community at large to support us in this decision.
I think another important thing about that strike is that we had a strategy, and that the employer in that case announced that we were permanently replaced the day we went out on strike. This was certainly not an employer who is hesitant to use whatever tactics were at its disposal to try to break the union. And yet the workers were clear that the boss could say whatever they wanted, but we made a decision that we weren't going back till we all went back. We would all go back together, and we would keep the pressure up until the boss was forced to reverse those words. And that's in fact what happened. And so after the 49 days after the boss said, you're all permanently replaced, you're fired, you don't work here anymore, everybody went back. Because we had applied a variety of pressure tactics, including applying political pressure, because the Trillium Corporation did depend on government contracts for money. We spent a lot of energy on public relations because the Trillium depended on its reputation for providing good care, and we pointed out that although our members worked incredibly hard, the quality of care was compromised by a very high turnover rate, and we really made that a top story in Portland, so that on the one hand, we had a practical impact on Trillium's operations because the reliable workers weren't there, and so they struggled to keep the place going. But coupled with that, we used political pressure and the pressure of public relations, and I think it was sort of the three tactics combined that created enough pressure that that, as I said, 49 days after announcing that we were permanently replaced, all of our members went back to work with a contract that, while not perfect, addressed all of our major concerns.
And when is that contract up? How much? How long did the new contract last for?
Well, that's an interesting story because the contract was supposed to last until the middle of 2007, and yet what happened earlier this year is the employer came to us and said, we want to sit down early and negotiate a new contract because we never want to be in that situation again. And so we were able this year, a year before the contract expired, to negotiate a new agreement which goes until the middle of 2008. And what's interesting is that this contract, we didn't face any of the proposals, the union-busting proposals that we saw 2 years ago. And in terms of the economics of it, we actually made more progress in this contract than last time. And I think of it kind of as a strike dividend where, in fact, the impact of the strike was much greater than the short term because it made the next contract much easier. And I think, like Colleen said before, it didn't just affect these workers. An entire industry was watching what happened here and recognizing the consequences that would be faced if their behavior was similar to Trillium.
Well, that's great. So this is great news for the workers at Perry Center and your local that you were able to, this strike had far-reaching effects.
I think it did. And I think that it also affected, shortly after we settled the Perry Center strike, we went into state bargaining, and for 17,000 state workers. And I think that the experience of the Perry Center strike was on the top of the minds of state negotiators as well. We really think that that any strike has profound consequences well beyond the immediate experience of the affected workers.
Well, I think when I think of the labor movement, I think of SEIU as being out there in front doing the best strategic planning for the future when it comes to. And president of your union is going to be in town tomorrow, isn't he?
Absolutely. Andy Stern, who just published a new book talking about his vision for the future of the labor movement and the future of America, will be in town on a book tour tomorrow. He'll be speaking at Powell's Books at noon. And doing a number of other public events while he's in town. We're delighted that our members will have an opportunity to meet with him in the evening. We really try to think strategically in our union, and that means having strikes when we need to. It also means partnering with employers when that's possible, because we'd always rather have a cooperative relationship than one characterized by conflict, and I think that's one of the things that Andy's going to talk about in Powell, some of the ways in which we've been able to fight with employers when that was necessary, but also build relationships with employers, because oftentimes we can convince them that there's in fact value added for them if they will work cooperatively with employees so that we can make progress together.
This is Bob Bussell from LURC. I just wanted to quickly add and to echo what Leslie was saying, but I think one of the really, you know, brilliant things that the strike accomplished was to show employers in Portland and perhaps throughout Oregon that, you know, that there are benefits of peace with SEIU versus going to war with the union. And while I know the union doesn't want to be at war constantly, it goes back to the point Joe McCartan was making earlier about the aftermath of PATCO, that having lost in many ways the ability to strike in many parts of the country, it's had some really damaging effects on the union movement, and the ability to wage a successful strike, which the Perry Center was in spades, has just had some amazingly salutary benefits.
Well, it always looks like a good strike, Colleen. Maybe you can say this. Maybe you can talk about this. It always looks like a good strike in the aftermath, you know, afterwards. But it was pretty tough for 49 days, wasn't it?
It was actually 59 days.
Oh, 59.
I'm sorry, Colleen.
I'll never forget that.
I lost 10 days there.
But, yeah, absolutely. There's nothing about a strike that's going to be easy. Like I say, it's a difficult decision, and every day of it was trying in a lot of different ways. But I mentioned in the beginning that it was inspiring, and it truly was. There were things that got us through moment to moment. One of them was increasing the bond and commitment we'd made to each other and understanding what really we were doing and taking a stand on. And that felt great. It felt great to say we're not going to take this anymore and we're going to pave the path for other workers to do the same thing and to hopefully come out ahead, but at least feeling great about the fact that we didn't just lay down anymore. But I have to say that the community was an incredible piece of what made that strike possible for us. They kept our spirits up, from the honking to walking on the picket line side by side, and just the solidarity that was accomplished through that was inspiring. And I hope that people that walked that line with us have taken that back into their own workplace and will put it to good use.
Well, I'd like to thank Colleen Sullivan for showing up, for Leslie for sharing her time with us to talk about this successful strike, for Bob Bussell down in Eugene for his insight into the strike, and for Joe McCartan for helping make Labor Radio successful tonight. I'm so excited to see people in the labor movement who can take these bold actions like that and spread their success around the labor movement generally, and hopefully in the future there'll be other opportunities for us to walk on your picket line to increase the rights and benefits of your workers. I'd like to thank my engineer Ben and Celeste for her pitching tonight, and you are listening to Labor Radio. Celeste, are you there? I'm waiting
yes,
for my
I'm
engineer.
Yes, I'm here. And I want to thank the folks who have called in and renewed. We have thanks going out to Pam, to Eric, to Tom, and to John for renewing their membership, and especially for supporting this program, Labor Radio, all about working people, the labor movement, and organizing. And speaking of organizing, we're trying to organize a lot of our listeners who are not members into the listener cadre. That's you, isn't it? You've been listening for a long time, and you keep thinking, should I? Yes, you should. And I tell you what, it's really painless, it's really gratifying, and it's really easy. 503-232-8818. 1-877-500-5266. We have folks waiting here right now to take your pledge when you call up to become a member. So we want to thank you for giving that shot. That's right. Give it a good shot. There we go. Now, the way we're looking at it, we still have about, what I say, three $60 pledges to make our goal. That's you. And you know what? It's really inexpensive. Three $60 pledges. A $60 pledge is $5 a month. And if you do that with electronic funds transfer, you won't even miss the money. All you have is a good feeling for knowing that you're supporting a very worthwhile nonprofit communications forum. That's what it is. KBOO Radio is more than just a business. It's more than just a social activist nexus. It is a communication center. We make sure that we get the news and information out. But it's not just that out action. This is what you call a reflexive action. It comes in, it goes out. It comes in, it goes out. It's a interactive
integrated action. That means we're listening to you, we're taking what we get from you, and we're integrating it in what we're sending back out to you. And if that's not enough, you can be a programmer yourself. So this is a very big circle of activity that we're asking you to come into, to join and to make your life a little bit richer and all of your efforts more meaningful by starting out by just picking up the telephone. 503-232-8818. That's 503-232-8818 here in the Portland metropolitan area. 1-877-500-5266 for all of our extended listening areas. And if you're on the web, it's KBOO.FM. Choose the Join Now button. Make that call. Join now.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers, Shopmen's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.